thank you again to Laura, Taka, and Noor for a wonderful presentation this morning. We have about 50 minutes for Q&A today. Just a quick note, there are about 30 people in the room, but we also have 110 people joining us on webinar from around the world. So to try to cover everyone's questions this morning, we'll take one question from in the room, then we'll switch to webinar, and then we'll go back and forth, okay? And I'll just ask, when you introduce yourself, to say your name and your organization. Before we take the first question really quickly, I also wanted to remind for anyone who needs to leave early, you should receive an email in about a week with the post-event resources, which is going to include a recording of this presentation and the PowerPoint presentation slides. So that should be coming your way shortly. So we'll take a question from in the room.
Can I just add one more thing, which is that the full labor market assessment and the executive summary will be up on our website, I believe, later today. So
it's available.
So it's at wfconnections.org, and you should go look at it.
Thank you. First question.
Hi, I'm Anastasia DeSantro from USAID. I have two questions. first question is, if you can, very interested in the Zimbabwe horticulture value chain example. As you may have expected, I have a question about where you got the data or how you sort of got to that level of detail at the precise processing function and the level of skills that you think are needed, and is there any nuance for some of those details? Second question has to do with gender. Very, very glad to see that you noted that factor in the different specific occupations. I just wonder, was that sort of something that came from the USAID mission, or you know, how did you decide to approach it from a sort of gender neutral angle? Because I do also think in a country like Zimbabwe, this is a very interesting time to maybe change gender norms, but whatever we facilitate now could sort of then be set in place for generations.
So, you know, the data for the value chain analysis came from interviews as they typically do. Unfortunately, Alec, who did the majority of those interviews, is not here, so I'm not, you know, I don't think we're going to be able to give you a lot of nuance on this, but there is a write-up about this, and we can definitely go back and forth. In terms of the gender lens, we decided early on in the Kenya assessment, which you were a part of, that we wanted to look at gender as an issue in terms of looking at where women either were working or could easily be hired, et cetera. In terms of the gender analysis in general for this assessment, I did want to turn it over to Taka because she helped us really understand the situation of women in Zimbabwe. You've got your own mic, right?
Yeah. So for the gender analysis, we did a lot of desk research first of all the gender analyses that had been done in Zimbabwe, and then we held focus groups. And in the focus groups, gender was a major part of our questions, as well as even in our interviews. So we used a lot of that information that we got from the key informants in our focus groups to inform which parts of the value chain that gender would have lower barriers of entry to, and just to get people's perspectives on that.
Great, thank you. We'll take that question from the webinar.
So this question comes to us from Jason Snyder, a graduate student in MSU. And he asks, does this tool account for the potential rapid value chain transformation of organizations? Is there a danger of training youth skills that won't be relevant in 10 years?
So, I mentioned earlier the RTI and Duke work, which was looking at where value chains are going and then mapping skills to that. We decided that we had to come down to the ground and we had to say, we need to talk about jobs today. The overall assessment absolutely looks at market trends and where things are going to be in 10 years. And the overall sort of skill supply and demand analysis does do that. But for the value chain analysis, we didn't feel it was helpful to have like a future value chain.
we thought that you had to actually come to reality. What are the channels right now that the product is flowing through? Who are the actors? And, you know, when you look at an arrow here with an entry point, there are jobs there, and those can be quantified, like how many actual jobs today, unfilled positions. So this is more like a, how can I say, you know, there. Earlier in the presentation, I was going to compare what we do and say that it's very different from a labor market survey. You have the ILO and the World Bank and a number of actors that typically go out and survey establishments and say, you know, who are you hiring now? And in our assessments, we don't really have the time to do a survey, but we usually look at those as secondary information. What we found, though, is that that information by itself, you know, as your question is alluding, is not very useful because things change so fast. That said, you know, the analysis also in the narrative around this map does talk about the trends and, you know, where there could be entry points tomorrow or where, for example, there could be pathways for an entry point today into the informal channel that could actually lead to a job, you know, tomorrow in the formal channel. So what we map is today, but what we talk about and what we analyze and the data that we gather definitely looks at the trends.
Do we have another question in the room? Maybe.
Hi, this is Zaki Rahim from DAI. Thank you for the great presentation. There was on the slide, I think it's two down from this one, the qualitative one. Yeah, this one right here. There's a mention of intrapreneurs. I just don't think I heard that in the presentation. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the dynamics of what that is. I think may have heard the term, but just want to hear a little bit more.
Let me do that one. Mm-hmm. So intrapreneurs, as you know, are people within organizations who are entrepreneurial. And we put that in here because, as you can see, this matrix really has two dimensions. And on the vertical axis is this idea of the level of risk a person is willing to take or interested in taking. And then on the horizontal axis has to do with the, you know, we originally called it, yeah, this level of security, but it's also sort of potential for economic growth, or so it's potential for income and potential for business growth, right? On the horizontal. So intrapreneurs may be somebody in a large company or organization who has decided they don't want to take personal risk of, you know, they want to have a salary, and yet they see new business opportunities. They may be starting off like a spin-off or an offshoot of that company or doing business in a new way, developing new products. So those, you know, these, at the end of the day, in these boxes, there are people. And so those are people that, you know, just like the deadweight employees, you find inside sort of larger companies.
All right. And another question from the webinar.
Steve Morris at VSO asks, are these toolkits available? And he's interested in seeing this, or is it still being tested and refined? So if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah, I mean, the goal is to get all of these online, and some of them already are, so at our website, wfconnections.org, we are putting them up as we are developing them and refining them, so it's a work in progress, but this will all be available online.
There's about, what, four or five that are up there now?
Yeah, I think about four at this point.
But you should call us on it if there's one specific one you want to see, and we'll accelerate it.
Hi, Eileen Hoffman from Chemonix. I have a follow-up question on this entrepreneurship landscape. On the level of security on the far right side, if people are employed, it's fairly easy to determine whether they are the dead weight or for the entrepreneurs, and to work with them accordingly. But on the left side, where we have entrepreneurship capacity and people are unemployed and potential entrepreneurs, I'm wondering what kind of assessment tools you might have or you're working on there to understand, especially with youth, where they fall on that scale, so that we can better determine then what types of interventions to do with them.
Thank you. The best programs that I've seen, and what I think might make more sense than an assessment tool, I think there are some assessment tools out there, and there are psychometric tools out there, but the best
programs I've seen use a self-selection process where at the end of the day, if you think about an entrepreneur and you think about one of their defining characteristics as persistence, right, and their ability to continually surmount obstacles and come back and try again. Some programs that I've seen where you have a little bit of open-ended requirements or stages of activities where you can choose to complete something or to come back again or to, you know, go out and get data on the market and come back. And they're not given a firm deadline and, you know, whoever comes back in a week with something good then gets the next assignment. So it's almost like a series of self-selection hoops. That would be my own recommendation. I've seen this done in different programs sort of partially, right? And sometimes at the very beginning before there's some sort of a selection process before a training. Sometimes it's after a training when there's, you know, do you want to write a business plan and not everybody wants to. So I think there are a number of ways to get at that and to use self-selection for people to express their level of risk and to make sure that there are programming options for the most vulnerable and for those who don't want to become a growth entrepreneur. I think the concern is that programs that try to push people to be a growth entrepreneur when that's not what they might be oriented towards is the thing to avoid.
Thank you.
Okay, and another question from the webinar. This, and I apologize if I mispronounced your name, Dudu, from an agricultural specialist from USAID Senegal asks, what is the place of illiteracy and unqualified person in the market labor in the context of globalization and competition in business?
Thank you for that question. And, you know, coming from Senegal, where I've actually had some conversations with a colleague of ours at FHI who's based there, Senegal having a large informal sector and Senegal having a private sector foundation that incorporates a voice of the informal sector, I think many students, many youth who have, you know, not completed primary education or may not have literacy skills may have trouble finding, obtaining a formal sector job. And so the question is, can we do better in our programming at identifying pathways from informal employment to that are not dead ends, that lead to whether it's greater, you know, lifelong income earning opportunities, or whether it's second chance, you know, skills delivery programs, or whether it's pathways into the formal sector and sort of, you know, workplace learning programs. It's interesting because I've seen more in Asia than in Africa, workplace kind of functional literacy programs. Large companies in Asia kind of figured this out, and they do training for people who have come from villages and who can't read, and they do training so that those workers can learn, you know, what they need to read for their jobs. And we spoke to people in Kenya and Zimbabwe and other places and employers, it was as if they had never heard of this modality. So that might be something interesting to explore in certain sectors as well.
We'll take another one here.
Yeah, Edward Winter, World Vision. So I had a couple of questions. So to what extent did you find the definition of youth as being under 35 constraining or helpful? Did you feel that there was some need to differentiate the various situations of those people? And the second question was around, to what extent did you attempt to factor in migration, or was that just not relevant, either rural to urban or international migration?
So on your migration question, I'm going to say that it's something we've begun working on, but I don't feel really ready to answer it yet. We didn't look at it in depth here. We tended to look either at urban markets or at rural markets. We didn't get into that. On the age distinction, I don't have a problem when you're looking at, let's say, 10 to 35, as long as you're able to slice it up, right? There's a 10 to 14 slice, which is going to be very, very different in terms of services and approaches from, let's say, the 25 to 35 slice. And then there's the 18 to 25 slice. I also don't like those three slices, though, because one of the most interesting data points I found was from a solar
sort of social enterprise called V-Lights. I don't know if any of you have heard of, operating in Kenya. And they have data on their rural sort of young salespeople that they use to distribute their products. And they have come up with the ideal age. And it's, if I remember correctly, it's like the middle 20s, you know. And why? You know, there's basically kind of a maturity level in terms of people feeling secure and confident enough to be approaching, you know, people to be showing the products. And yet they're, I guess, young enough to have the energy to sort of be willing to go out and do this job as opposed to being in a different stage in their life. There's sort of like a sweet spot that they have. And I think there's, so I don't have a problem with somebody defining youth with some age group. I think where work could be done is looking on the economic side and starting to say, well, okay, so we know that about rural retailers. Well, what do we know about some of the other occupations and the kind of, you know, what age youth tend to perform best in those jobs? Because that's going to have them be more attractive to employers, and there are going to be some programming implications that come with that information.
Okay. One from the webinar?
Jonathan Lashley from the University of West Indies in Barbados asks, where would apprentices and interns fit in the entrepreneurship landscape? Their level of security would depend on how employers in general utilize their skills. And he says, I assume that would vary by country, but just wanted to get your thoughts on it.
So the way we thought about apprentices and interns, and actually in Zimbabwe there's quite an organized system called attachment for students after they finish or even before to spend some time working in an enterprise. We considered that under the formal job placement track as opposed to what we're calling here the entrepreneurship track. So somebody who's an apprentice or an intern is actually working in another company. So they're not an entrepreneur, they're an employee. So that we didn't have them in this framework. As I mentioned, there were sort of two programming tracks that should be not completely separate, but sort of different how we were thinking about it. So for internships, you want to be thinking about placement, right? You want to be thinking about, does that experience then lead to either a long-term job in that company or another company? Or, and you know, that could be an individual that learns about a value chain or a sector and then comes and then enters this framework and ends up deciding to sort of take advantage of a business opportunity in the value chain. But while they're an apprentice or an intern, we sort of consider them on the other side.
Hi, my name is Catherine, I'm a consultant. I have two questions. My first question is, you said that in Zimbabwe, your recommendations were training plus, but you never really described the plus.
Shira, are you ready for this one?
If you could talk a little bit about the plus. That's the first question. And the second question has to do with linkages between levels on the ladder. You know, I've noticed this, at least in the way you've been talking about it, you really talk about individuals. And you're talking about individual quality characteristics, individual personalities, individual where an individual happens to be in this map. But what about linkages? You know, individuals are embedded in organizations. So if you look at the kind of organizations that are capable of growing in this kind of, I'm not talking about public sector organizations or parastatal. I'm talking about private sector models. And it's who's looking at that.
So I'm going to have Kira answer your question about the recommendations. On the linkages, it sounds to me like what you're describing has to do with enterprises, and I think there has been quite a bit of work done on linkages between enterprises and how that affects their ability to grow. It's a very good point that's not really incorporated into this analysis. I'm not sure how to do that at this point, but I'd love to discuss more. Kira, why don't you pick from your, so Kira has a long list of bullet points that include some of our concrete recommendations, and she's going to pick some that fall into your question. Because I don't think you want to hear them all. But you're free to look at the reporting and get the full list.
So I think in terms of training, the plus part of the training plus recommendations, that we saw that there was a lot of opportunity to integrate youth into a value chain, into businesses, so that they can provide strategic services to those businesses to enhance growth. At the same time, they're receiving technical training and experience through that process. So there's a win-win situation
maturing. Similarly, there are opportunities to do human resource management within businesses to better enable businesses to make use of youth employees, to make use of interns, and so that there is this integrated relationship that has to happen between training youth and business growth.
Let me just add to that. There's sort of two formats of what we were actually proposing. To some sort of specialized consultant, so that the youth isn't just, here, hire this youth with some limited skills, but there's actually, the youth is actually bringing something additional that is of value to the business owner. That's sort of more of an SME formula. The second is for a larger company, where the owners of the larger company, and specifically the timber company we interviewed was a case in point, but there may have been others. I wasn't on all the interviews. Often your business owner is really concerned about their mid-level managers and their skills, and they will even pay for that, but they're not as interested in putting money into or even effort hiring entry-level youth. When you can negotiate a package deal which includes some piece of technical assistance that that business wants, whether it's, you know, partly paid for by them or however you think it's justified to do this, you can get better buy-in for them to commit to both hire and train those youth. And we've seen this work in other countries as well and had some examples that we shared at the USAID mission to convince them that this wasn't a sort of a crazy new idea, but it was actually something that's typically done in economic growth programming. And that in this particular case in Zimbabwe was going to be really important. There was kind of an extra push that was going to be needed if we were really going to see placement take off in the numbers that, you know, to make a difference in this context.
One from the, none from the webinar at this time. Keep the questions coming. We'll take another one in the room.
Hi, my name is Raul Radcliffe. I'm with Block by Block. And my question is more around the youth engagement pieces in the labor market assessment data collection phase. If young people were engaged, obviously part of the buy-in is from the very beginning, getting young people to understand the equal part. And then the second part is, I thought if you could speak to how either employers responded to or the conversations around youth or people with disabilities entered into the fold.
Okay, so for the youth engagement and the labor market assessment, I was a youth representative, but we did do focus groups with unemployed youth and employed youth, but that was as far as the engagement worked. We only had 3 weeks for the assessment, but it was part of our recommendation that the youth are involved in their own success in the labor market, you know, even with through interventions that help them to map their own opportunities. Yeah.
Either from the employers or how did young people or people with disabilities factor into the questions that you had for the employers, the engagement? You know, was it at a level where there were, you know, there was some sort of effort to train or have employers, you know, have people with disabilities be a part of the workforce?
We didn't really explore that area.
I did want to say that both in Kenya and in Zimbabwe, we had such a fantastic experience with our youth consultants that we sort of saw a natural follow-on to the assessment being, you know, a more structured kind of youth engagement process and youth data collection. We also think that that would contribute, specifically in the entrepreneurship programming, to youth understanding the value chains in which they may be working as a self-employed vendor. You know, understanding business opportunities, part of it comes from understanding how to connect the dots in the market you work. And so that's really valuable information. So we think that that's a very, very promising area for programming. We would have loved to continue to do it, but there wasn't, you know, necessarily sort of a planned activity after our assessment. But for everywhere that we did this, we suggested this be worked into whatever interventions were being planned.
Okay,
France from Haiti asks, firstly, thanks for you all for sharing this great presentation, and asks, will the labor market assessment tools be help map promising trends in jobs and livelihoods creation, and how do they help identify existing and future gaps in supporting youth employment and livelihoods?
So again, in each country, we orient, although as Nora presented, we have sort of a broad range of tools, but in each country, there's somebody with a question that we're focusing on. So in this country, it was really this issue about jobs versus entrepreneurship, are there really jobs in Zimbabwe, et cetera. In Kenya, we did a little bit more what you're asking about, and we do it with the background economic analysis in every country. So there's a series of data tools that we use to say, where are there likely to be jobs? What are the growth sectors? And we do use data for this. We have found that in some cases, donors may just select sectors kind of based on finger in the air or, you know, apparent interest in sectors or apparent high labor intensity. So we really try to look at a series of filters, and it's sort of another presentation. You know, we have a whole sort of sector selection process that you can use, and that we don't recommend that it's only we that do this. I mean, this is something that I think either missions could do for themselves, or local organizations could be doing, because there are so many open source databases, so you can go on and get, you know, export data to understand the growing export sectors. You then need a little bit of qualitative information to map those to what are the informal sectors in the country, and are they cyclical or counter-cyclical, right? Are they going to grow with those exports, or are they going to be sort of counter-cyclical? You can look at product-based data, and what we did with that, and that's open source also from MIT, you can map, so for milk and dairy, which is a growth sector in Kenya, we mapped adjacent sectors that were under the radar that are still quite small, but that are going to grow in an associated way with milk, right? So cleaning products, certain types of cleaning products that you need in a pasteurized milk plant, glass bottles. There were three or four of these, there were some packaged pharmaceuticals that were actually related to milk production, just because of where they came from or the way the packaging was. So you can map these adjacent sectors. And the product space is also interesting because at the end of the day, they are also mapping kind of the stock of skills in a country, the stock of capabilities. What are the sectors that are likely to grow together via a kind of a spread of skills? And at the end of the day in the labor market, that's what you want to see. You want to see skills flowing through the market. So there's a number of ways in which we do this. The data in Zimbabwe was not that great, so we didn't emphasize. We used those filters, we made those slides, and we did that analysis. But we kind of felt like, how much do we trust this data? Whereas in Kenya, data was pretty good, although they did adjust later their GDP by 20%. So maybe it wasn't as great as we thought. But there was lots of data in Kenya, and we were able to come to some serious conclusions based on a number of these open source databases. So that would almost have to be like another session where we went through those tools. It's a good one for data geeks.
Right, but these tools are available for you or whoever to take on and do this analysis for yourself. So
yeah,
that's kind of one of the larger goals of this work.
Yeah.
Okay, another question? Hi, I'm Yancy Chen from For the Children. I have two questions. The first one is about job safety issues. Like, would you take any steps to assess the labor market, workforce safety environment in the framework you just mentioned? And the second question is about, we're helping a country staff to do the labor market assessment themselves. So do you, would you suggest any recommendation on the resources to put and also the time to take to do the LMA by themselves? Thank you.
I'm just gonna answer the safety question. It is something that we noticed because we visited workplaces and we saw there were issues. At this point, the way it figures in our reports is as a side note. I think the first order of business was just to identify where are their jobs, where's their growth. This side note is something that, you know, when a donor or a government or whoever is looking at sort of programming and aligning the labor market, we'll need to start thinking about what are ways to address that. We didn't go into depth though, but Nora's gonna answer the second piece of your question.
Yeah. You know, our resources are open to you. We hope you will use them. Come to us and talk about how you might do that. In terms of how long a labor market assessment takes, I mean, we could spend forever, right?
what we've done so far is generally about 3 weeks in country. A couple of weeks desk research and preparation beforehand, 3 weeks in country with a team of about 4 or 5, and then, you know, several weeks to a month of, you know, follow-up analysis and interviews, chasing down that all-important data that we didn't always get when we were in country. But, you know, we'd love to talk to you about what, you know, what resources we have. Check out our website, and we know that we don't have everything up there yet. So if there's particular demand for any of these tools, let us know. All of these tools are sort of being put together into a comprehensive guide. Right now we're filling in the pieces, but we will have the whole picture soon.
So I also just wanted to add that, you know, that's the way these particular assessments have been structured, based on both maybe a mission demand and a calendar. If they're looking at program design or reformulation, there was a reason why they wanted something quickly. But in the longer term, and certainly something that we've recommended in every case, interventions on the ground want to be thinking about analysis as part of intervention, not just something that you do once. And similar, I'm seeing a lot of people who've been around in private sector programming and agricultural programming, the way that value chain maps and end market analysis and all of those pieces have come to be a part of intervention. And a lot of that information is useful to the private sector, and it's part of the private sector engagement strategy. So this is the same thing. When you want to do an initial scan and start to understand what are the pieces of data that are going to continue to be interesting to the employers, and you want to build that into your intervention so that eventually this won't just be, well, we only did this because it was 3 weeks. I mean, I think for all of us, the idea is to have this built in.
And we're getting close to time. We'll take one last question.
Thank you. My name is Steve Senna from the World Computer Exchange. So I have a question and also a comment on that slide here, the entrepreneurship landscape. So the question is, just curious how all the sectors seem to be ag, or I guess, or ag-oriented, or you only mentioned those, I don't know. So I'm just curious where that initiated. Was it part of the research that showed that that was where the growth was going to be for, say, the secondary education in the stocks and flows, the biggest segment was secondary, or if that was a programming matter for the project, or if it came from the government, or what have you?
So it's a very interesting question, and Taka, if you want to add anything to this. You know, it was a function of what we found, because we went in there open-minded and looking at a broad sort of potential list of sectors, and we could have come out with some things. There were some things that certainly showed potential, like ICT, like tourism, and we did name as a pocket of growth something that we called business services. However, at the end of the day, there was also the issue of how many sectors could we look at in depth over the time period that we had. And the deal with the ag sectors is that because this was typically historically Zimbabwe's strength, that some of the largest sort of business leaders and private sector leaders in Zimbabwe right now are excited about kind of rebuilding or moving forward these ag value chains. And so there was energy around it. There were sort of actors that we could interview and get data. And to go into, and it's worth doing, to go into more detail on ICT or tourism in Zimbabwe would be worth it. But it was because those sectors are also dispersed, right? And there was some confusion as well. So people would say, well, tourism is big. And then you looked at some of the data and they were counting everything that was retail. And not every coffee shop is actually serving tourists. And so there was just a whole, we were going to have to start to split those apart into a number of smaller sectors. Whereas in the ag, there was some volume, there was some activity, there was some energy. So we wanted to kind of make our point. Like I said, we would hope that they would continue to then look at these other sectors and break them apart and look at the potential there.
Okay, thank you. So on the landscape here, I'm just curious. I mean, you could do a lot with this. It's a great illustration of static, which it has to be, I guess. You can't really project or what have you. But I thought, wouldn't a secure business owner be considered an entrepreneur? And wouldn't some of your independent contractors be considered entrepreneurs? So I thought maybe that last box you could.
Well, everybody in here is sort of a different type of entrepreneur.
Okay.
That's the idea.
I see.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's a bad nomenclature to have the sort of high risk would be entrepreneurs up there in their special box, and then it looks like the other ones aren't. That was not the idea.
Got it. Okay.
So we may need to work on what we're calling them.
Yeah, no, then that makes sense. Well, yeah. The title is entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Maybe it's entrepreneurial. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
And one final last comment before we wrap up.
This is Kristen O'Planick from USA. One thing to one of your points anyway, I think in the room, and maybe because of who our normal audience is for these seminars, there's obviously a lot of interest in the value chain analysis overlay, which I wasn't surprised. But I just wanted to make the point that in so many of the places we work, there are existing value chain analyses that would be very easy to take up, and you have a great starting point to then do this overlay with. So it's not like you would have to start from scratch and do the whole value chain mapping yourself.
Which we didn't.
Perfect.
And it's the first thing we do in any country is we get, and this is, the missions are so helpful with this because we just get all the value chain studies that exist and we look at them.
Great. And to your point, Laura, that you made earlier, you know, that in each of those you could even put another piece there with how many positions are currently open and what are kind of the trends looking at. And I've definitely seen them where they try to quantify how many companies are even at each point in there. So you could be how many different potential employers. There's so many things you could do with that. I am particularly taken with that piece of analysis. But and I would also just like you to give you an opportunity to comment on, I know that you have in the not too distant past formed some working groups around some of these issues. And if you could just please share with our audience a little bit about those working groups in case anybody would like to get involved that isn't already.
Sure, yeah, thanks for that opportunity. Yeah, we have formed sort of based on the priority of the members of this community of practitioners who are working on workforce development, working groups around systems thinking, understanding how to use a systems lens when looking at workforce development and at labor markets. And so that group is active and meeting, I believe, every 6 weeks or so. And there's also a group meeting looking at demand, and they're particularly interested in skills demand, employment demand, but particularly at demand in the informal sector, so that may be of interest to some of you. That next meeting is the systems group is actually next Tuesday. You can attend in person at our offices in DC, or you can attend. We have a webinar. We'll have an interesting presentation by RTI about a workforce ecosystem assessment that they're doing. So if that's of interest, Tuesday the 24th at 9 a.m. And then the demand and informality working group next meets on March 5th. So all of you are invited to attend. Please see me or email us if you're interested. Or Jackie should be here somewhere. Jackie's in the back. Hi, Jackie. So let her know if you're interested, sign up. And then we have a recently formed group that's just now getting off the ground, which is looking at measuring employment outcomes. So some of you may have attended this event. I unfortunately could not attend. You weren't there either. Maybe some of you in the room were. But so there's a working group starting up around that. Do you want to talk a little bit about what they're doing?
Rachel, do you want to talk about that? You were there, the outcome. I can say, basically, the idea is to kind of clarify what indicators are currently being used to track outcomes in workforce programs, then to maybe move towards some better practices or some better clarity around indicators. There seems to be a lot of custom indicators, and yet there are some that should be common or might be common. So maybe identifying some common indicators, maybe clarifying what kind of indicators do you need if you are taking a systems approach or that you want to have kind of at that systems level. There may be basic ones like number of people trained or job placement and how far out do you follow that in time. And they seem basic, but the data collection around them might be complicated. So there's all of these issues are being looked at. We put out like a 5-page briefing paper and held an event, I think, a week or two ago while Nora and I were in Kenya. And that briefing paper is online, and then there's a longer lit review that's coming, which just reviews a variety, over 100 sources on indicators currently being used. There's a lot of aspirational literature out there. A lot of people have written papers on how they think it should be tracked. But we put those in a separate chapter because nobody's actually doing it. So with this community, perhaps we can actually get to a better place.
Yeah, and I should just summarize by saying that the point of these working groups, they're defining their own deliverables, but which can be knowledge products or additional tools, and some of those are already coming out. We are in the process of awarding learning grants to some groups that are developing tools that we will put in our toolkit. Yes?
Can I make a plug for the talent plan?
Sure.
I didn't want to cut you off.
No, just that that those will be coming out of these working groups, so if you would like to be involved, we hope you will sign up. And if you would like to see the products of those will be emerging over the next, over the life of the project.
So, and I want to thank Rachel for pushing us to try to really take what we're doing and not have it be a black box and have it be out there. And as Nora says, you know, we're trying to make it an open source enterprise where others can contribute their tools and their approaches and refine, you know, our tools. On that note, I just wanted to let you all know that Taka is here with us. In addition to coming and us being lucky enough to have her here today, that wasn't the only reason she came. She's helping us design and launch something which we will put out a call for learning grants. And this is maybe more interesting to some of the webinar participants because we're hoping to have organizations in the field, maybe in Africa and Latin America and Asia, apply to kind of manage a little bit of like a professional development platform for young people interested in working in what we do, in development and workforce development. And so the Talent Cloud is thinking about these types of activities, such as a youth-led or youth participatory, you know, market assessment, having some fellowships awarded and having youth be able to get guidance, maybe attend trainings, conferences. Taka's designing it. This is youth-led. So we're not in charge, she is. But talk to her if you're interested in that, because we are interested in any organization that thinks, you know, this could be, so who could be a fellow? Somebody in Kenya or in Zimbabwe could apply to be a fellow and could work with a partner institution in their country. Somebody also at an organization in Washington, like a junior professional, could also apply. I mean, the idea is to get these people forming a network. So we're interested to know your thoughts on that, and please talk to Taka.
Okay, and with that, we want to thank our presenters again for a wonderful presentation, and to all the participants both here in the room and on webinar today. So thank you again.